And on behalf of probably all of us who are presenting today, I want to thank Garrett for organizing all of this. He is truly the heart and soul of Cal OSHA. So this is the official cartoon of the Aerosol Transmissible Disease Project. The Aerosol Transmissible Disease Project per se started in 2004. But its roots go back to the TB epidemic or increase in TB cases, particularly multi-drug-resistant TB, in the 1980s. Cal OSHA started working on a standard around then, and in 1992 or so actually started proposing rulemaking on it. It ran into a whole bunch of rocks. And when Federal OSHA in 1994 announced that they were going to do rulemaking on TB, our chief at the time, John Howard, gladly put our rulemaking effort on hold. Then in 2004, when the Bush administration dropped rulemaking on TB and put respirator use against TB under the general industry respirator protection standard, which requires annual fit testing, and there was, of course, a whole uproar that people here probably remember, the hospitals and the unions in California came to Cal OSHA and said, let's take a more comprehensive approach to TB and other aerosol, well, we didn't have the term aerosol transmissible diseases yet, but other airborne infections. And so we had a total of 10 advisory meetings and a whole lot of other discourse with everybody. And in May 2009, two standards were adopted. And there are a couple of them were delayed. The provisions were delayed until September 1st, 2010. The standards have been in full effect now for the standard for 3.5 years and all provisions for 2. So I'm going to talk about a few cases. Why am I talking about them? Well, because some of those cases are still being litigated and the compliance officers can't talk about them because it's like giving a free deposition to the other side. So I'm going to try to summarize some of what went on and explain how this standard is beginning to work in California. So the standard was adopted as H1N1 or 2009 H1N1 was getting started. In March or April, the first cases were detected in Mexico or announced in Mexico and then the United States. And this standard was adopted in May. But actually, our very first inspection under this standard had to do with a county TB clinic who shut off the ventilation to their sputum induction booths that were being used for suspect TB cases. And so an inspection was done by Mark Harrington, and that was our very first case under this standard. But in H1N1, the standard was new. Cal OSHA was not at the table with the public health agencies when it broke out. And the standard actually gave us some standing to work on joint guidance, to work on respirator supply issue. We worked with the California Department of Public Health, Occupational Health Branch, in rolling out a training program for long-term care facilities and primary care clinics on respirator use because, remember, at the time, it was a novel virus. And the CDC and the California Department of Public Health were recommending that it be treated as airborne, that respirators be used, and that airborne infection isolation rooms be used. So that put it right smack dab in the middle of our standard. And people will all remember the issues of fake respirator shortages and real respirator shortages and issues about releasing the stockpile. And having the standard actually gave Cal OSHA some ability to participate in discussions that otherwise we would have been excluded from. But then in December 2009, we had a case that kind of revealed some of both the strengths and the weaknesses of the public health system and how our standard plays into it. So the ATD standard, for those of you who don't remember it or know it, had a lot of provisions, most of which were taken from CDC guidelines. So it involved source control like masking and separation of suspect patients. It involved engineering controls like airborne infection isolation rooms, negative pressure rooms, and sputum induction booths and things like that. Respiratory protection and personal protective equipment, of course, a written program, exposure investigations, medical services, and it even had a biosafety standard embedded into it for labs. And then there was a second standard that addressed exposures to animals. So in December of 2009, some Oakland police officers were summoned to do what's called a welfare check to an apartment where a person who had been missing from work for several days. So they called the police, they asked them to check on the welfare of this person, and he was found more or less unconscious, lying down on the floor, and the police officers attempted to roll him in order to clear his airway. And then the EMT, all the police officers had were gloves. And then the EMTs arrived, the emergency medical technicians arrived, and they, of course, had respirators. And they took the patient to one of the hospitals in Oakland, where he was worked on by a team of, 10 or 12 people, one of whom was a respiratory therapist who helped to intubate the patient. So the patient was brought in on Thursday evening, and by Friday morning, he was already a suspect case. All the states in the United States and most countries have requirements to report meningitis cases to the local health department or to some health department. In California, it goes, you report to the local health department, who reports to the state health department, who then sends the information on to the CDC. They were supposed to report this case on Friday morning when they knew that it was a suspect meningitis case, but they didn't. And they didn't report it the following day when they had lab results showing that they had these bacteria that were consistent with meningitis. And they didn't report it on Sunday when they had tests confirming that it was Neisseria meningitidis, and I'm sorry I didn't pronounce that very well, but that's a picture of them on the board. They didn't report it on Sunday. They finally reported it on Monday. By Monday, one of the Oakland police officers was already seeking health care at a local hospital and found out that he had been exposed to meningitis, so let his doctor know that, went to the emergency room, and he was hospitalized for a significant period of time. The following day, the respiratory therapist, who had not been informed or prophylaxed, because bacterial meningitis, typically people who are exposed are given one dose of something like Cipro, and that's prophylaxis and prevents them from developing the disease, but this had not happened at this hospital. So the respiratory therapist also developed significant disease, and that's actually how the Department of Public Health found out about it, was that hospital reported the case. And then the hospital finally initiated its exposure investigation. Some people who were exposed were not prophylaxed for 12 days. Bacterial meningitis has a very short time frame for a very short period to develop to disease, and in fact, that's illustrated by this case because the police officer was getting sick over the weekend. And it was a major subject for discussion in developing the aerosol transmissible disease section because we said prompt reporting. There are some diseases that need to be reported immediately so that exposure investigations can happen. So Garrett Brown and Jennifer Ziprick at the State Health Department worked up this case. Citations were issued to all of the employers involved, including willful serious citations to the hospital for failure to report, failure to conduct exposure investigations, and failure to provide medical follow-up. We are extremely lucky that neither the index case nor the two secondary cases died. Because it has a high case fatality rate. And some of the secondary cases had small children who were also exposed. So then, this is a kind of an interesting course of the aerosol transmissible disease standard because no sooner did we have this meningitis investigation, and I realize that's a Kalosha-centric view of the world, but nonetheless, then there was the pertussis outbreak in California where we ended up having more cases than we had since, like, just past World War II, pertussis being, of course, whooping cough. And what contributed to that is that they had taken the old vaccine, which was diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, which used a cellular form of pertussis. The pertussis component was what was thought to provoke most of the, bad swelling of the arm that you may remember as children from your tetanus shots. So that component was taken out, and in 2005, a new vaccine for adults was licensed by the FDA that had an acellular pertussis component. So in 2005, that was licensed by the FDA. It's called Tdap. In 2006, the CDC recommended that all healthcare workers receive that vaccine unless they were within 2 years of a previous tetanus diphtheria booster. So by 2008, all healthcare workers should have been vaccinated against Tdap, and they would have been prepared to deal with this pertussis outbreak. But in fact, what happened was less than 50% had been immunized, even in children's hospitals, less than 50% had been immunized. I'm going to want to move on quickly to the lab part of the standard. As you can see, there's been this enormous increase in biosafety level 3. Those are pathogens that can be spread through aerosols and cause significant diseases. That's a graph showing the increase in the United States of BSL-3 licensed facilities. And most of these exposures occurred in California. Our standard requires biosafety plans, biosafety officers in every lab who's handling BSL-3 pathogens, or some of the ones that are covered by the ATD standard, like TB, that are considered BSL-2. And I won't talk about that recent meningitis case, but there was a researcher who recently died while working with meningitis, from meningitis. All in all, we've conducted 59, we identified 59 inspections through the somewhat imperfect mechanism of our IMIS system. We've cited a number of violations, most commonly the plan, respiratory protection, and of course medical services. And just for a second about zoonotics, the second standard was about zoonotic diseases, diseases that can be spread from animals to people, one of which is bovine TB. And since 2000, we have had a number of outbreaks of bovine TB among animals, and that is a huge economic issue because it lowers the TB-free status of California. All states seem to be TB-free, but some are more TB-free than others in the USDA system. So California went down in that. Last year, we had two outbreaks of bovine TB in dairies that were identified through slaughterhouse surveillance, and our inspectors went out. And in one of them, the situation, they kept having more and more cows who were infected and detected, and eventually it led to the USDA paying to eradicate that whole herd. What we found were failures in, What we found were failures in when disease is detected on a farm or a farm is placed under quarantine, our zoonotic disease standard requires increased precautions to protect the workers, including recording when they go into areas where infected animals are, use of respiratory protection in enclosed areas, providing of medical services. We found a big conflict with the TB local health department about whether they were going to do TB testing on workers exposed to bovine TB, although the aerosol route of transmission is probably the most important now that we pasteurize milk. So I'm going to leave that at that, and thank you for your attention.
So as I mentioned,